So are we ready?
We're ready, John. Go.
Oh, wow. It's been so long. As always, I'm John Lickman, contributor to The House Next Door, and now unemployed.
I'm Vadim Rizov, semi-employed contributor to The House Next Door.
Editing, as always, with his very cute drink, as Kevin remarked, is Keith Hewlett.
Thank you. Hi, John.
And this is our Season 2 premiere.
Wow.
It's kind of scary.
Are we going to list it as Season 2, Episode 1, or Episode 19? I'll let you crazy kids sort this out. I don't give a shit.
Yeah, we really don't care.
Okay.
It'll be episode 19, season 2, etc.
Okay.
But Santango Summer.
Summer Satantango.
Oh, whatever.
There we go.
Summer Satantango.
Because this podcast will be even longer than our usual adult
Introduce bullshit. Our very special guest stars. This is like an all-star
yes.
lineup here.
Yeah, it's the grassroots all-stars. People who we always find at the bar, thankfully. But from left to right, we have St. Van Airesdale.
Hello.
Of the Reeler and Defamer fame. Kevin B. Lee of...
Yes, of Kevin B. Lee. And today I'm just a substitute silent partner for Vadim, who I expect to speak liberally today, since he wrote a 5-page tome in preparation of this event. And I'll just be the designated drinker and alcoholic scorekeeper. That is, I'll be doing a shot anytime someone says something of importance or just downright funny or witty.
Okay.
The Dark Knight is the greatest film of our generation.
Shut.
Kevin, I just want to say, Kevin looks really fucking sharp right now. He looks really good. You can't see this at home, but Kevin is actually rocking shirt and tie and really the most dignified.
Two sets of standard that we all must
this,
follow.
This is the
we'll
sharp
take pictures.
Side.
We'll take pictures.
Yeah. The other two.
Also, Preston Miller, director of Jones and Damn Handsome Man.
Thank you. Just trying to rock that Zardoz look.
Hey.
Drink, Kevin.
We're going to give Preston.
I am Zardoz. It's the Wizard of Oz. Oh, my God. Okay.
And fellow contributor to The House Next Door, Slant, Reverse Shot. I think you write everywhere. I don't know.
He hasn't written for Reverse Shot, have you?
No, I have not written for Reverse Shot. Slant, Filmmaker Magazine, the Horror Magazine, Pangoria.
Name?
And one day, Slant.
Oh, no. Name.
You're lucky.
Take two.
And his name is?
His name is Jeremiah Kim. And he will never talk to us again.
Greetings.
Okay. So what are we doing here?
Well, we are reviewing the summer that was.
Yes.
Now that fall is here with its bitter chill and New York Film Festival. And everyone's all a Twitter.
That's really funny.
Did you like that? So, I think we should start out with the first major summer film, which was Iron Man.
Which I did not see. Who's seen Iron Man?
Seen it.
Raise of hands?
everybody else has seen Iron Man, except for Keith.
Okay, well, I'm out of this, which the futurist wants, so please, go ahead.
It's kind of big. So, Stu, I heard you have a very interesting take on Iron Man, especially when it comes to superhero films, in that you think that Favreau did a very open interpretation of superhero, or that Iron Man is better than Dark Knight when it comes to doing a superhero film.
If you've heard that, I'll take your word for it, but you didn't hear it from me. I do prefer Iron Man to Dark Knight, and I do prefer that kind of more, just kind of, I guess, I don't want to call it a lighter style necessarily. I mean, you know, Iron Man is, you know, riven with torture and geopolitical crises and things that, you know, The Dark Knight doesn't dare touch, really, but it's handled in a very light way with kind of almost, you know, romantic undercurrents with the relationship between Tony Stark and Pepper Potts. And as far as Favreau's handling of the film, I mean, it's really just smart for him to just get the hell out of the way. You know, he's got extraordinary charisma in front of the camera. He's got a great script. He's got good practical special effects by the late Stan Winston. And he can just, like, you know, clear a path. And that was the smart move. That's the best thing he could have done. And that's, I think, why it works better than, you know, the really heavy-handed Dark Knight, which I like as well, but it doesn't hold a candle to Iron Man.
And you were talking last week about how it was a weird summer that everything that was supposed to be a temple thing actually came out kind of decent or better, which is not usually the case. And Iron Man is an early exemplar of this because no one actually seemed to hate Iron Man. I don't know anyone who really loves it, but everyone seems to agree it's perfectly fine.
No, I saw Iron Man twice. I really enjoyed the hell out of it, you know, and I wouldn't say love it, but I thought it was a great film, and I stand by that. I think everything this summer, with the exception of Indiana Jones, has lived up to the hype. I really do. I really do. I think, you know, Dark Knight was overhyped, but that's not its fault. You know, I think people just kind of jumped on the Heath Ledger bandwagon and didn't let go.
So my favorite thing about Iron Man is this wonderful trend we have this summer, where in the past we'd have like bullshit action stars who can't act, and this summer pretty much every movie had actual actors in it. Like Iron Man, it took a long time for Robert Downey Jr. to, I'm not sure anyone saw him as an action hero, and he really didn't do that because he was in the suit the whole time, but he did his thing, which he's been doing, you know, for a very long time now, that shtick that's kind of calcified because he used to be like the chameleon who did Chaplin and all that crap, and now he's finally figured out. Know, this is what he's good at. You have Gwyneth Paltrow, you know, coming out of hiding, and Clark Gregg, among, you know, other Terrence Howard, a bunch of, because this is great. They figured out that the franchise value outweighs name actors, you know, which I haven't seen since Russell Crowe kind of like stormed into Gladiator and just took it by force because, you know, he wasn't supposed to be a star before that. So I think this is just terrific. It's a trend exemplified in Wanted, starring James McAvoy, previously the wimpy, weedy Atonement, and Hellboy 2, which I like and probably no one else does, starring people like Ron Perlman.
No, there's two of us today.
Oh, excellent. Well. Yeah, I accept The Mummy, Tomb of the Dragon Emperor from this roundup of stellar casting. But that's my favorite thing about Iron Man. And, yeah.
So you exclude Mummy because you're a racist?
Yes, because I'm a racist.
I knew it.
I love, if you've seen the Olympics trailers that use the mummy to tie into the Olympics,
no.
Like, this summer in China, and then Jet Li is yelling, and then cuts to the dragon, and it cuts to, like, you know, the parallel bars. It's just, I was amazed that the Chinese people, someone in China sued over Kung Fu Panda. They said it was an insult to the Chinese people, this appropriation of the panda. The mummy tomb of the Dragon Emperor was not vaguely insulting.
Because it can turn into a dragon. Like,
yeah, a three-headed dragon, yes.
The entire population of China can do that.
The Kung Fu Panda thing is fascinating, though. Not to jump too far ahead or out of the loop, but I mean, you know, China was absolutely, you know, shaken to its core by the success of Kung Fu Panda for several reasons. I mean, culturally, like, the panda is their symbol, and the animation as well was something that they thought they should have a lead in. And the fact that a panda was kind of depicted as slovenly or lazy or like the certain cultural traditions were kind of lampooned in a way for American culture was absolutely...
The thing is, if Stephen Chow was doing that film, it'd be the exact same type of character and they would love it.
Yeah. They took it very personally, I think. Yeah. And so even that, I mean, the phenomena this summer are great even. I mean, the multi-layered, you know, implications of summer tentpoles are even fantastic. Right. It's great.
It's got global implication. Yeah. Iron Man too. I mean, Iron Man is sort of a war allegory. I mean, depends on how deeply you want to read into it.
But should the Chinese make a movie about a lazy bald eagle?
Because was it someone?
I would watch that. That's a good point. I would totally watch that. Welfare eagle.
Wasn't it
welfare eagle?
Why are your people starving on the streets?
Gently as a bald eagle. Right?
My picture is Sam the Eagle from the Muppet Show, gone alcoholic.
Who would voice well for Eagle, though? Seriously, it wouldn't be Jack Black, right? It would probably have to be Seth Rogen, I guess. Or
Nick Nolte?
Yeah.
Who was the guy that did all the Muppets?
Sam the Eagle's
fantastic. So I'm sure the Chinese government will get Zhang Yimou to like work on animation and just kind of upgrade their skills. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but I would consider the opening ceremonies of the Beijing Olympics to qualify as a movie.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
So I've only watched about half of it.
I mean, it only cost $300 million to produce.
Which apparently, did you read the article where it said that the people watching it at home saw CGI?
That's not a big deal.
But that's interesting.
Only one classical dancer paralyzed, too. You see that?
Right.
Well, out of the amount that participated, that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I'm surprised no one died, really. I mean,
that was the most amazing thing about the opening, is it really sends a very strong message to the rest of the world about a quarter of the fucking globe lives in China. And the fact that he was able to orchestrate so many people at one time really gave gave some credence to that, and everybody was shocked across the world to see how many thousands of people were working in unison, and maybe sent a bit of a shiver up the spine of you know, especially America or people that think that they're the top dog. But I tell you what, numbers are going to out eventually.
So the Cold War is alive and well and present in China.
I thought it was better than any old Soviet display of power. This was really taking it to a whole new level.
It really did.
Yeah. And like, this is great because it confirms my theory that Zhang Yimou's been prepping for this for like basically the last 5 years. Like, House of Flying Daggers was like nothing compared to what he pulled off. Like, infinite, like 100,000 extras or whatever the hell it was.
Well, now I'm going to watch it.
It inspired me to like want to submit my first spec story to The Onion, which was Chinese government appoints Zhang Yimou to run China. I guess.
Yeah, give him all little boxes. Like,
that would be very pretty.
Yeah, it would be very
slow motion.
It was just great because in the opening stages of the ceremony, there'd be like some like dazzling display of like 10,000 people open their cloaks and use, and they cut to like all the lights come on, Hu Jintao's just sitting there, and it's just like so underwhelming.
Yeah.
John, what's going on?
Thank God we covered all this while we were talking about Iron Man.
Yeah.
So I think we've effectively killed Iron Man for that point. Iron Man, good start to the summer, got us rolling. What came next? What was the next big...
Quick thing on Iron Man, though. I mean, it is a very interesting compare and contrast to Dark Knight, because both of them do have kind of dark stories. Tony Stark is an alcoholic. He tries to, you know, he's in the movie, he's an arms dealer. He's basically a mercenary. He sells weapons to kill people, and he becomes reformed. Dark Knight doesn't necessarily become reformed, but definitely they grapple with these issues within themselves, just from a superhero point of view. But Stu is right. The handling of Iron Man, I thought, was actually more effective. Definitely less ambitious, but more, kind of more effective from an audience point of view. Me being the audience in this particular case. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to compare and contrast.
Well, yeah, you can kind of create a link between Iron Man and a lot of the other movies that were good this summer. Is that once, as Vadim was talking about earlier, once we take it away from like movie stars and making it about movie stars, if you make the movie about the movie star, then the character has to be really likable and has to be really positive and has to be all these like really wonderful things. But the minute that you make the movie about the franchise, oddly, it seems that you can make the character more ambivalent, more ambiguous. So Iron Man, you know, it's like Tony Stark is kind of a spoiled brat, you know, when he's outside of the uniform, and when he's in the uniform, he's kind of like the smart bomb that can, like, destroy all the bad guys but keep all the innocent survivors alive.
Well, and to go with the movie star thing, where does Hancock fit into that?
That's a movie star, though, you know, it's like, that's Will Smith. Even though the guy is a total asshole at the beginning, by the end he's totally redeemed.
Right.
Which to me is like a very superficial story, and then Hancock loses interest with me halfway through, whereas in Iron Man, he doesn't get the girl. And in Dark Knight, he doesn't get the girl.
Sequel, I mean,
right. Maybe he will, you know. But at least like they're like jerking us off real nice, and like you know, making us wait for it.
Reminds me of Frank Zappa's Joe's Garage Appliantology for Iron Man.
But this does get us into Hancock, and the difference between Hancock and Iron Man is that Iron Man doesn't get everything by the end, whereas Hancock does. And why does Hancock get everything by the end? Because he's played by a big movie star, Will Smith. So in the beginning, he's a drunk. And he's an asshole, and he doesn't care about anybody. But he has a change of heart. And, oh, he's good with the little children by the end. And, like, he's saving people and all of this stuff. So,
he's,
you know,
riding on the moon.
In a way, weirdly, Hancock is, like, the most superficial movie of them all. Because it's like, oh, it's the pseudo-dark movie. Whereas, actually, like, Iron Man and Hellboy 2 and Dark Knight are actually willing to go there a little bit more. And say, like, okay, let's kill off some of these characters. Or let's make our main character a drunk who, like, smokes a lot of cigars and, like, doesn't know how to deal with women. You know, this is way more interesting than Hancock, where it's like, deep down, he's a really good guy. The other movies kind of say, deep down, the superhero must be pretty neurotic, because if they're, like, putting on a uniform and saving people, they must be kind of fucked up.
Okay. Well, the fact that they did that this year was kind of interesting. I mean, I've never seen a Will Smith.
But that's the difference. It's like Will Smith.
Separation.
Sure, and that was like that was an art house, whatever indie movie.
Right.
Now Will Smith is a big movie star, so the movies are tailored to him. You know, whereas these other movies are not tailored, they're not tailored to Christian Bale, Robert Downey Jr., or Ron Perlman.
Right.
But this one was tailored to Will Smith.
I think Iron Man was absolutely tailored to Robert Downey Jr. Yeah,
as an actor, perhaps, you know.
No, because, I mean, I love RDJ, and I love that thing that he does, and I hear that some people think it's getting old. It hasn't gotten old for me yet, but it wasn't different from what he's been doing, you know, ever since his big comeback. It's not markedly different. I mean, there's different. It's contextual. It's always contextual.
I agree with you as much as they got Robert Downey Jr. personal trainer, you know, and now he looks really fit, you know.
Yeah, but it's like that's
Burger King, buddy.
Yeah.
he's still pulling it. I mean, he does his improv thing. The dialogue scenes are markedly different from the action sequences because
But don't you think it's nice that like a big, huge blockbuster movie has Robert Downey Jr. doing his riffing?
Yeah, but I think
as opposed to like the indie stuff. I mean, like he was doing like he had no stock value whatsoever. He was doing James Toback movies and The Singing Detective.
5 years. I mean, I know as little as what 3 years ago he was in The Shaggy Dog with Tim Allen, but you know, times have changed. And
I mean, he was good in all those movies. I found it very refreshing that Downey Jr. was the guy carrying this movie, and that they would let him rip.
And this isn't stuff. Like he set a precedent, because I think this is the same thing that Johnny Depp did with Pirates of the Caribbean, or at least the first one.
I think that was
when you were talking about the last time that a director just sort of stepped out of the way and let the movie kind of like work its wonders, and you know, no profound way, but a very entertaining way. I think Pirates of the Caribbean was the last one that did.
I have to give like Jon Favreau a little more credit than Gore Verbinski, who just, you know. Well, if you've seen The Weatherman, then he will not stand back. He really does. Pirates of the Caribbean is one of the most boring blockbusters I've ever seen in my life.
But here's a Jon Favreau thing.
Weatherman is better than Pirates of the Caribbean.
Here's a Jon Favreau thing that'll tie us into some other movies this summer, which is like I don't think that I thought Iron Man was a really fun movie and the actors are very good characters, all that. But I don't think Jon Favreau is a great action movie director. The action scenes in Iron Man, whenever he put on the suit, was a CGI guy flying around. Yeah. I didn't think it was very good. The opposite was Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which is a lousy movie. You know, it's a really lousy movie.
It begins.
Hold on, I'm gonna go back.
I mean, like, in terms of like being an action filmmaker, Steven Spielberg has it all over Jon Favreau. He doesn't have the characters, he doesn't have the plot, he doesn't have the human interest, he doesn't have anything, but he can craft a set piece. Where it's like a Buster Keaton thing, where a guy's like...
What does that mean, though? I mean, it's like, okay, great, you can...
All I'm saying is that Jon Favreau, like, you know, whenever, like, Iron Man is doing his tricks, it's pretty boring. You know, which still makes it a good movie, like, because there's so many other good things in it. Yeah. And, like, you know, Crystal Skull is the opposite, where it's, like, the only time that it's interesting is when they're doing
their
tricks.
Indy and the Jones ain't lousy.
I want to say this real. The great thing for me about Favreau and Iron Man, I don't think he's a great director, but I think it's fantastic that he brought in this confident, lightweight movie at 2 hours without infused with all the angst of these other superhero movies. I remember reading about in Superman Returns, I never saw that, you know, he hovers in the Christ pose over the Earth. There was none of that nonsense. Like, Favreau's really confident. He gets in and out in 2 hours. It's like, it really freaks me out that something like Iron Man costs like $150 million, you know, thousands of talented people devote 2 years of their life to this stuff, that ultimately I don't find that memorable, but perfectly pleasant. But it's like, if you have to do it, and it's going to be this efficient, that's probably like the best case scenario.
I think it's worse for a filmmaker to have really well-crafted set pieces in the service of a completely nonsensical final product.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that is... That's the worst thing Steven Spielberg could do. I mean, it makes him a bad director. It's like, yeah, you can kind of, you know, you have the parts, mm-hmm. but you can't put them together, you know? It's mm-hmm. like, yeah, Favreau may not have had the flying sequences together, and yeah, they were poorly scored, you know, and all those things. Yeah, there were, you know, but this is the first time he's ever done it, you know? And he actually pulled off pretty well, I think, under the circumstances, you know? It was cohesive. And then Spielberg's thing is like, well, you know, we can do the set pieces, and we can do, like, fucking, like, who are those guys who come out of nowhere and, like, beat the shit out of LaBeouf and Ford?
The Guardians of the whatever it was.
Yeah, there's like a emo piece, you know, in the middle of...
Can we do a quick yay-nay on Indy Jones? I know
they're
yay. Anyone else
look,
yay?
I'm also a nay, to be frank. You know, it's like, I think Spielberg's a real filmmaker, and he's got real talent, but that was definitely a nay, for all the reasons that Stu's talking about.
I'm a decided yay.
And I'm a mild idiot.
And that's the thing that really frustrated me the most about it. Frustrated me the most about Indy 4 is that I do so appreciate Spielberg. I think he's so gifted.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the Indiana Jones franchise so mm-hmm. much. I mean, I cherish it. It's like,
can you estimate, can you guess when the project got away from him? Was it in the script phase or...
Well, you know, like, Lucas has talked about this in recent interviews. He's basically said that he had very specific ideas about what Indy 4 should be, and he kind of held the cards. It was his baby, and he was the one who had veto power over Spielberg's ideas. And so, yeah, there, I mean, there are the large conceptual parts about Lucas's, you know, kind of, I guess, reign and control over the franchise, but there are also very, you know, smaller technical inadequacies as well. There's things like Dennis Kaminsky cannot shoot in Indiana Jones
film. He finally laid off the fucking flare, which I was so grateful for.
It's great.
You are huge on that.
Finally, Jesus.
No, it's like, I'm sorry,
George Lucas, it was a beat.
Slocum, I mean,
someone had to.
You know, I know Slocum's like 90 years old or something like that, you know, but I mean, look, just bring the guy back. Let him have an apprentice do it, okay? Because, I mean, those films, though, just the look of the first three films was what I was missing probably the most out of anything. It's like that really awful kind of painterly Cate Blanchett, you know, Cold War Villatrix, whatever. It's like, fucking shoot me, man. It's so
now, Keith, you really loved Indy 4.
Yes, I did.
Right? You really loved it.
Yes.
Now, and we've talked about this before, and it's been a bone of contention between us, but, like, what... Like, why? Like, what was it that, where is the Father, Son, Holy Ghost in this movie for you?
Why do you do that to me? Fucking seriously, why do you hang the religious stuff over my head like I'm a fucking moron? I'm just
saying that you seem to connect to it in a spiritual way.
And it's beyond that as well. I mean, I think it does. It is of a piece with the other movies. I think it kind of completes them in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing the other parts of the trilogy and having Karen Allen come back, I mean, just that whole emotional kind of story to it just really clicked for me. I mean, a lot of people said she was a bad actress in it or something, but I actually felt that she was very... She was unexpected in the sense that she seemed... She sort of threw the movie into a strange rhythm that I actually kind of liked. Now, beyond that, too, I think the movie has a very poetic feel to it with the way it's sort of divided into the stanzas between the atomic bomb explosion and the UFO, which I think are very cognizantly set up, you know, image-wise, you know, to sort of reflect each other. You know, and I see that throughout the movie, and, you know, I feel like I've written all this down, and, like, I've explained it to people, and if you don't get it, you don't get it, but it's kind of like, I hear all this, you know, it's like I watch Shia LaBeouf and Harrison Ford talking in the movie, and I think it's great, because they're actually conversing. And like the diner scene, for example, when they're in the diner together,
the diner scene is fantastic.
The diner scene is great because it's like a Minnelli movie. It's like he watched the end part of Brigadoon when Jane Kelly goes into the theater.
Sir Theo Kenny's compared to an Edward Hopper painting, and if you watch the lighting on it, it's golden to a degree that Stretch to Sleep is also terrific.
And the way that he makes exposition essentially into, I think, philosophical dialogue, which is always a challenge.
And that whole 15 minutes.
But I mean, there's I think it was Andrew Saris who said that there's nothing more cinematic than two people talking. And that's what's wonderful about it, is that I think that father and son talk in this way where they have this implicit connection that they're father and son, but they don't realize it, and the whole movie is about kind of unraveling to that point and getting to that point. And then when they do, it's like the Spielberg theme of the family unit coming back together. And, you know, I mean, I think there's more to the movie than that. I mean, I think the fact that the aliens, which they're not aliens, they're like, which of course was the
they
big,
were the aliens.
No, the bi- no, the big mistake in AI was that everyone thought they were aliens when they're actually mechas.
The big
mistake here is that they're not extraterrestrials, they're interterrestrials. I know you're looking at me like I'm crazy just to make that distinction, but it's important because you know, when John Hurt says they go to the space between spaces, that's a very intentional verbal thing that he's talking about. And it's like they're not going into outer space, they're going into like this inner space in between things, you know, where you just sort of feel them spiritually. They're the spirit, in a sense.
We're all sitting here like wolves, actually, right now, like waiting to pounce. Let's let Stu go first.
Here's the thing. I can't disagree with a single thing Keith just said. I can't disagree with any of it. But the only thing I would add is that I actually would repeat that, you know, it's another really fantastic technical accomplishment of Steven Spielberg's that doesn't work in the service of a cohesive final product, you know? And I mean, like, the last shot of the film, it's basically, you know, another kind of a Close Encounters reprise in a way, you know? Not the final shot of the film, but the spoiler
spaceship?
The spaceship.
It's the beginning of the new season, no spoilers.
This amazing CGI shot that lasts, I mean, at least 2 minutes. I mean, it's fucking extraordinary, right?
Yeah.
And so there are all these moments, whether it's, you know, Shia LaBeouf and Harrison Ford talking in a diner, you know? Minnelli, as you said, very pagerly, brilliant, you know. Or whether it's an action sequence in the warehouse with the magnetic alien head and the Russians and all kinds of stuff. Or it's, you know, that last CGI shot, you know. Or it's the ants sequence, which was unbelievably horrific, probably the most horrific thing I've seen all summer.
Right.
You know, a guy getting eaten by red ants.
Yeah.
You know, but it's all these things are great. You're fantastic, you know, as individual set pieces, but why? What does it mean? What makes them spectacular as a whole? You know, what connects this?
What makes it spectacular as a whole is the slow reveal, and I think the implicit reveal of the family, bringing the family together to the point where they realize that they are together. I mean, that's what the set pieces do. You know, the set pieces are a momentum thing. He uses momentum in a way to push the family drama, and he doesn't emphasize the family drama like bam, bam, bam. Like, honestly, you know. Well. In Dark Knight, where it's like all about chaos, 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 chaos. This movie's about chaos, you know.
So mocking the corpse of Heath Ledger right now. So
no, I'm not flogging the corpse of Heath Ledger.
We said mocking, not flogging.
But no, I mean, you're going to say something, John.
Well, I just like to respond to the family thing that you talked about, the fundamental themes of the movie.
I don't know. It feels
perhaps so, but like his idea of what a woman is, to me, like, got so much more reduced when we were talking about Indy 4. So Karen Allen, who was introduced in Raiders of the Lost Ark, drinking another guy under the table and proving herself to be like a very strong, independent woman who was taking care of herself out in the middle of the desert, is reduced in Indy 4 to being a woman who is like spent the past like however many years thinking about Indiana Jones. And like saying like, why did you leave me at the altar? And then he's like, I still like you, honey. And she smiles. And that seemed to be like all that she was about, was like, Indy still likes me? Oh, I'm so happy. And suddenly she's a reduced character. Suddenly now all she is like a girl who longs after Indiana Jones, who's a big movie star, and she has a big, huge smile. And like, you know, if she's representative of the audience, I don't think the audience is with her anymore, because I don't think they care about Indiana Jones anymore. I don't think they even look at Indiana Jones as a person.
Isn't Karen Allen gorgeous, though? I mean, still.
Absolutely. That's one of the things.
To me, Indiana Jones movie was Karen Allen, actually.
She's a beautiful woman.
I love seeing her again. I love the fact that she's not a fashion plate, and that she's not, you know... She's looking her age.
She's not Allison Duty.
But she has no.
She's great. And she actually adds a bit of naturalism that kind of flies in the face of the CGI.
I disagree, though, Kristen. I feel like she has no personality beyond being the woman who's attracted to Indiana Jones.
I see your point there, and I think that's more of a construct than it is like her abilities.
I don't think
she was given a lot.
No, I agree. She's a wonderful actress.
But I have to say one thing. On behalf of Keith, I mean, I have to say I didn't care for Indiana Jones, the fourth one, as much, but I love the fact that how you are able to see the poetry in it.
Yeah.
I mean, that is lovely, and that's what, in a sense, that's what it's kind of all about. I mean, say 90% of the people miss it, but I would never consider Steven Spielberg a poet, but maybe you would.
Yeah,
I think that's awesome.
So, segueing from Karen Allen, I'm actually curious, since summer is traditionally such a boys' season for movies. You know, can anyone shout out some like great female characters in any movie that they saw this summer? Female performances are just great.
I want to get
to see female characters.
Gillian Anderson in the X-Files movie.
I would second Keith on that. I mean, that's the only one I can think of too.
I mean, that's a performance that will not get noticed. But if you look at the last shot of that movie, at the one before the end credits, she does this subtle turn with the camera
kind of.
I agree with you, Keith. The movie is about her, and that's very rare in any movie, or any summer movie in particular, where it's about the woman.
And the fact that she plays the role so seriously and all the twists in it so seriously goes overlooked. I think more things change the more they stay the same. Fantasy, unless it is slathered with significance on top, to the point where people say this is significant, the creator is saying this is significant, is going to be ignored because it's not enough for it to just be. Well, and I wouldn't even use just. It's not enough that it is a science fiction movie or just a fantasy movie. It has to have some resonance, a la Cloverfield or The Dark Knight, with like, you know, the current state of the world or something as people see it. And I think the thing is, the state of the world grows out of the movies. It does not come from being slathered on top of it. And too many movies slather it on top of it. And that's what I got with a lot of the movies I saw this summer.
I want to shout out Gwyneth Paltrow in Iron Man real quickly, because I'd kind of forgotten why she was famous in the first place.
Yeah, she got a raw deal with that film, though.
It was like an underwritten part, as were pretty much every part besides
with it.
And that's what's great about Iron Man. It's like Terrence Howard and Gwyneth Paltrow and Clark Gregg all bring like... Yeah. Way more like subtext or whatever.
Very thankless roles.
Yeah, this is why I applaud this trend, because those roles were not written at all. They were functional.
And
that's
like a constant professionalism as opposed to like Robert Downey Jr.'s kind of grandstanding, which is really fantastic to watch. Oh. But, you know, to counterbalance that, you have these kind of role players, and they fill their roles perfectly.
I had forgotten about Gwyneth Paltrow because she had done things like Do Duets, which is like a personal project for her. And so it's good to see her like perform her function, which is to bring resonance to parts that don't have any.
I'll vote for Anne Hathaway and Get Smart. And she's had a pretty rough summer personally, but I mean, she was fantastic in that film. Gorgeous, really. I don't know, really filled out the character well. It was another underwritten character that I thought she did great in. It was strange and strangely kind of similar to the female robot character in WALL-E.
Eve is the Mac, right? That's what I love. WALL-E is the PC, Eve's the Mac. She's great. Yeah.
And that was such a weird film because the gender thing was kind of imposed on that movie, and yet it was still very endearing to watch. I mean, we're just kind of hardwired to, you know, appreciate love stories, even if they're like completely contrived. And I don't know, the two of them just worked out really well. That was like the best chemistry between two characters in any summer film. And, and Eva is just great. This kind of, like, you know, she can be butch and, like, kick ass, but at the same time be very sensitive and giggle. Which is...
Now, I didn't see it, nor did I really want to, but did Angelina Jolie dominate the movie Wanted? I mean,
She was kicking some ass, but she wasn't a strong female role.
I kind of want to fight you on that.
Can we do the spoiler? Okay, spoilers for Wanted.
Spoiler.
No one here cares. I take it you didn't see it.
I love it.
I really like it, and Wanted, if you haven't seen it, is just like this insane movie that takes off where Night Watch and Day Watch, Teamwork, Big 5 Minutes, previous movies left out, and have about 25 minutes of like, what the fuck did I just see? Because it defies the laws of physics and plausibility, which is what is supposed to happen, because you're paying for this shit.
It's great.
And Angelina Jolie.
You wake up in a wax bath, you wake up with a Russian guy beating
you. So Jolie does this thing that's basically straight up Greek tragedy, a weight that is not earned by the moment of Wanted. You know, Wanted has no moral gravitas to it, except what it claims. But when she, like, shoots that bullet around the circle, that's a fantastic... It shouldn't happen, and she does it. So I want to give props to her for that.
See, that's why I want to give props to her, because I think she actually managed to help carry that film with the James McAvoy one-dimensional I'm a whiny little bitch.
Yeah, McAvoy has... I have no...
I thought McAvoy was hilarious. You know, that was another part... His monologue should have been like trite Fight Club bullshit, and he actually pulled it off.
I do admit the final monologue was awesome. In the last few months, I've done this. What the fuck have you done?
No, not even. You know, the speech where he tells off his boss should be just like a sop to everyone who works at Walmart, and it actually comes off a little better than it should be. And then Bakhman Bedev was his complete lack of taste, which is a good thing in this case, has the fuck you keyboard flying out with you with the two.
Does Morgan Freeman play? Morgan Freeman play the same part in Wanted that he plays in The Dark Knight, which is
now, Morgan that's Freeman. More like it, Mr. Wayne. He revisits his glory days of Street Smart with Christopher Reeve, and that he gets to say, "Shoot this motherfucker," which I know I've been waiting to hear Morgan Freeman say for a long time.
In real life, he got to revisit Driving Miss Daisy.
Yes.
Put him.
That's a shot. Drink.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Yeah, I like Wanted. Wanted is like Transporter 2 with $75 million budget. Like, it just is nothing. It's completely impossible, and it revels in this ridiculousness, which is what it should do.
But that's one of the great train derailments.
Oh my god. It felt like 18 stories or something.
Like, oh man, that's a blog entry waiting to happen. Top 10 list.
Yeah, it's like. Duel of the Sun that had the great train derailment off the hill. I can't remember, but
I was thinking of Transporter 2 when the plane crashes in the water and they have an underwater fight in the plane. That was the last most ridiculous thing I've seen. Yeah. Wanted just.
But that train derailment just was insane. I enjoyed every minute of Wanted. I thought it was hilarious. I didn't think it was heavy handed. It got philosophical, but I had to. And again, Vinny was right. You're paying for this shit. And it's going to have these weird interludes where you're like, you don't really care like what's being said. You just care who's saying it. And the fact that it is portentous and very pretentious in that way doesn't really have that much of an impact. It's just, you know, drama for the sake of drama in between a bunch of ridiculous action.
And
you want to see. I'm afraid I loved it. I loved
everything. I want to clear this up right now. There was a lot of shit taken by various people like Manola Dargis and whatnot who claimed that Wanted was an ugly parable of American post 9/11 assertion through violence. And that they claimed that, you know, the whole like thing where he beefs up and kills people is just like our country. And I just want to point out that Timur Bekmambetov was born in Kazakhstan, right. And Russia is a notoriously xenophobic nation, and he made the highest grossing movies in Russian history until he was outgrossed. And I'm pretty sure that he encountered a fair amount of opposition, and if you look at him, he's a big dude, he's gone to paunch since then. So I think that has nothing to do with our nation, and has everything to do with him. Like, if you notice, the one Russian character in the movie does nothing but drink vodka, talk shit, and then get killed. Which I think is pretty much Timur Bekmambetov's message for all of Russia.
You're missing the one great line. Is that
Are
vodka?
You Russian? Is that vodka? Yes. Are you Russian? Russian?
Yes.
But that's it. That's it. That's all he has to say.
All the Russian fanboys in Moscow going, woo!
See, this brings
like
up
in this country.
This actually brings up something I would love to address with Hellboy.
Oh.
In terms of like,
how was Selma Blair in that movie? I'm curious.
She was Selma Blair. She did what Selma Blair does.
It's a Ron Perlman show for me.
But that's it. We're looking at a thing that's built on action sequences, character design.
Hellboy 2?
Yeah.
Hellboy 2 is great because it doesn't have a plot. Spoiler. And then they fly to Ireland and meet the paraplegic Irish goblin. Like, you cannot make this shit up. It makes no sense whatsoever. It's fantastic.
See, I'm wondering, just like Del
so
Toro,
wait, all right, wait. Let's back up for a second, because Vadim, all right, I agree with you. That's like a wonderful thing about the movie, and Hellboy 2 works. But Indy 4 doesn't. But we're both saying
Hellboy
that
2 works better than Indy for me.
But these movies are both like nonsensical. They're built on set pieces that don't really matter. Why does Hellboy 2 work and Indy 4 does not?
Indy 4 has some downtime for me. Indy 4 does definitely. And like
except for the fact that Indy 4 does work. Moving on.
Right. So the diner sequence is gorgeous, but there's some stuff in Indy 4, especially Cate Blanchett, who finally pissed me off for the first time. But,
it's bound to happen the way she's
Hellboy 2 is it does not have any downtime, and the one downtime sequence it does have involves them drinking Tecate until they get drunk, which I can totally get
behind. Well, that's a set piece too, though. It's like the set piece is these guys are going to get drunk, and then when they have to
Hellboy
save the day.
Hellboy 2 is set to stun, because I've had this problem with Guillermo del Toro, is that he thinks the message is, his message in Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth is like fantasy greater than fascism, you know, like, he's one of those annoying people who gets them in class, is like, have you heard about Joss Whedon, you know, like, he really wants to convince you of the series as a fantasy, but in the Hellboy movies, he just goes on stun mode all the time, he doesn't have to lecture you, that's why Hellboy is great. Hellboy 2 actually is an inconvenient truth with monsters.
Shut the fuck up, that's fucking bullshit.
No, it's true.
That's fucking bullshit, no, you're wrong, Adib. It's it's a fucking waste, it's a fucking disaster, and it can be a truth. What the fuck are you talking about?
Oh, I know most people hate it, I know that.
I'll leave you guys
with
this
environmental message embedded.
It's like, that sounds really smart and fucking.
Wait, the environmental message part, or the rest of it?
Yeah, the whole, like, inconvenient truth, I mean, I understand, like, you know, what makes it, you know, what gives it the traction? What gives it the cultural traction, the social traction? You know, and any sort of, you know, because isn't the idea of inconvenient truth or any film that actually has some sort of social or cultural traction that, you know, it's something that you can relate to, something that kind of is in your life. I mean, Hellboy, you know, it's Del Toro kind of like, you know, jerking off. It's masturbatory, and it's really kind of exploited in the worst kind of way. You know, it's fantasies. I like fascism. you know, better. I didn't finish my sentence though.
Thank Kevin.
Fascism, you know, it can be surmounted by fantasy or whatever, you know. And that idea, it works for me at least. It's like it's a theme that at least you can play with, you know. But these kind of tropes of monsters, you know, just for monster's sake, you know, don't necessarily represent anything that don't have to, and he failed to kind of
This will take about a minute and a half to get through, but basically, first of all, like I gave about 6 months ago when a friend pointed out that I thought Great World of Sound would be popular, and it's not that I kind of like do not realize what will connect with people. For me, Del Toro, you know, when he does that fascism versus fantasy thing, which he said twice in Devil's Backbone and Pan's Labyrinth, Blade 2 is completely impersonal, but I enjoy it. Hellboy 2, on the face of it, is sort of Lord of the Rings jerking off in my face. You know, it's got goblins talking their own dialect with the subtitles, which is just absurd. An inconvenient thing, truth, is just, like, basic things. You know, the forest monster explodes, you know, and then they're like, wouldn't it be a pity if that died? It's kind of an environmental thing, but
it's an analog that but doesn't say, belong. I don't think you can read anything. And I mean, look, because we've already talked about Wanted and other trifles of the summer.
Oh yeah.
But you know, Hellboy 2 is not. It is a trifle in the worst way, and I don't think there's anything legit or deep. There's nothing deeper thematically going on in any of the film whatsoever.
That's why I like it.
That's fine, but don't liken it to, you know, more substantial. And again, I'm not here like to say Ink Between is the greatest film ever made. I'm just saying it at least has, you know, some basis in reality, right. And it can actually speak to an issue, can speak to a matter. Don't elevate Hellboy 2 to anything more than a souffle. And it's even a bad souffle. It's a fucking souffle that's been sitting in the sun.
It's a quiche.
For like the last fucking week. You know, and it's got flies on it. And someone took a piss on it.
I think the environmental message is deliberately built in because it's so heavy-handed. You know, they say things like, wouldn't it be a pity if we all died, in reference to the forest monster which beautifies New York, and they all say, like, oh, isn't it so beautiful? Like, if anything, it's not subtext, it's text.
Right, here's a segue question. Is there any... Because a lot of these summer blockbusters try to deal with issues for whatever reason. I don't know even why they feel obligated to do so. Did any of them do so in a way that actually worked and wasn't just like a token nod?
I think we're actually go back to the Hellboy thing. Uh-huh. I actually kind of support. I kind of dug Hellboy because it wasn't what it was. I mean, it wasn't supposed to be. I don't know if Adin thinks. I don't think he thinks it's heavy issues anymore. I didn't think it was a piece of shit at all. I mean, in general, I thought it was kind of like a canvas for an extraordinarily imaginative filmmaker. And from Pan's Labyrinth to this, I preferred this over Pan's Labyrinth, simply because it had a little bit more plot, even if it is just kind of a comic book plot.
Right.
Pan's Labyrinth, I thought it was far too heavy-handed.
Yeah, and pretentious.
And it just didn't...
It's a confusing comic book plot. What's it about?
Necessarily pretentious.
Oh, it's not about anything.
But I think...
Hellboy 2 is a cinema of attractions. I mean, to me, it's like Attack of the Clones. Attack of the Clones is a lousy movie, but it has like these awesome aliens in every scene, and there's never the same one. It's the same thing.
And
like,
on the note of George Lucas, I'm going to cut you off.
But then on that basis, shouldn't you like? I mean, should we all like, you know, Indy 4? I mean,
yes.
No, but
great, Kevin.
Because we've already stated how, or at least, I don't know. I mean, I guess this is my same problem with it. I think, you know, what I've heard around the table a little bit tonight is that, you know, Indy 4 is a collection of set pieces in the service of kind of a vacuum. And Hellboy 2 is the same thing, except it's done more sloppily and with less conviction. And so, as such, I think that there's really nothing redeeming about it. At least Indy 4 has the technical, you know, bravado to go behind it.
I think there's plenty redeeming about Hellboy 2, and I don't think I would compare it to Indiana Jones because it doesn't have that pedigree. It doesn't come from a modern classic, as it were, or classic series. I mean, it is what it is on its face, and I think that's kind of enjoyable. Indiana Jones does offer, at least it makes the offer to read us as deeply as you want to read us. You know, you can have just a gay old time, or you can just, you know, there's a lot of substantive stuff there. Hellboy is, there's nothing substantive about it, really. And I think it's a wonderful outlet for this extraordinarily creative guy to kind of, like, it's a great canvas for him to paint his stuff on. I think he's going to get there one day, that his imagination, or his lack of ability to realize a fairly brilliant storyline is going to match up to his extraordinary imagination. That's going to get there, and I actually think he took a step in that direction with Hellboy over Pan's Labyrinth.
Well, we'll agree to disagree.
And it's on that note that we're actually going to take our first break.
Thank you.
So we will go out on Ruby Tuesday for a few moments, and then when we come back...
We're going to Ruby Tuesday right now.
Ruby's
gonna blow up a restaurant.
I'm actually thinking Outback tonight.
Outback?
I'm thinking Outback.
Of Montreal is there. Let's
if we
do
go
it.
To Fridays, I'll still have it my way.
Are we going somewhere?
No.
Yeah, no, we are actually pausing.
Okay.
So we will be right back.
Okay.